Hello. On this week's program, we speak with composer Behzad Ranjbarom. Jean-Yves Tipidé performs his piano concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra in concerts this evening and tomorrow afternoon. David Patrick Stearns profiles the female a cappella group Anonymous Four, who perform at the Holy Trinity Church in Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia on Friday and at the Leffler Chapel and Performance Center in Elizabethtown on Saturday. And we speak with composer Bill Cunliffe. He's been nominated for a Grammy for his fourth stream, La Banda. The work was commissioned for the Temple University Symphony Orchestra and trumpet soloist Terrell Stafford. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Composer Behzad Ranjbarom was born in Iran and entered Tehran Music Conservatory at the age of 9. At 16, he was imprisoned for possession of cultural materials offensive to the regime of the Shah. After his release 3 years later, he came to the United States to study music at Indiana University. He later earned a doctorate in composition from Juilliard, where he now teaches. Despite more than 35 years in exile, Ranjbarom is strongly influenced by the culture of his homeland. His work often integrates elements of Persian and Iranian music into a Western musical framework. His compositions span a variety of forms, including chamber music, concertos, a symphony, and an orchestral cycle, Persian Trilogy, three works inspired by stories from an 11th century Persian epic poem. The Philadelphia Orchestra is this week performing Behzad Ranjbarom's piano concerto with conductor Robert Spano and the French pianist Jean-Yves Tipidé, both of whom premiered the work with the Atlanta Symphony in 2008. I spoke with the composer earlier this week at the Kimmel Center. So your music has always been accented with the music of your homeland. Has that become less or more so as you've been in the United States?
I would say it's more accented as I live and the United States has been many, many years. But more I feel that I go back to my roots. And part of it is because I traveled back to Iran several years ago and traveled many cities. And that rekindled my interest in cultural aspects as well as the music. So I would say this is more in tune with the elements of Persian music.
To a lot of Western ears, Eastern modal music, music from, well, let's say music that's not Western classical music, can be a little difficult to interpret. Do you have a sort of an internal filter where you decide when it's becoming too Eastern for Western ears, or is it just as it comes?
Well, music of Middle East and music of Iran has particular characteristics. One is monophonic. Second is very ornamental and highly embellished. So I would use some of these characteristics in my music. You would hear certain passages that are embellished in a particular way, and also some rhythmic elements that come to play, as well as color. To me, color is the most important part of what I work with orchestra. So that, to me, is a very much inspired by the Persian history, Persian carpet, and Persian legends, that kind of emotional attachment that I have with the culture comes in terms of color.
You talk of color, and you also talk of the percussive elements, both very evident in this piano concerto. You wrote this for Jean-Yves Tipidé. You're not a pianist, so you're both writing it for a specific pianist and on an instrument that you don't play. How difficult was that?
Absolutely a pleasure to write for Jean-Yves Tipidé, because he's not a pianist of black and white notes. He has a palette of a rainbow. So you have multiple colors, as well as technical brilliance. So entire composition, I was envisioning him playing the concerto. So instead of relying on my two fingers, I had Jean-Yves playing in my head all those passages. So it was a main inspiration. Another part of the inspiration came from an instrument called daf. It's a Persian framed percussion instrument, and that is a prominent role in the third movement, which is very dance and festive character. It was used in weddings in Iran, as well as brass. plays a big role, and you hear it right at the beginning of the concerto. It really goes back to the ancient celebrations in Persepolis.
And also a nice little interplay between the harp and the piano.
Oh, that's the high point for me. I'm glad you brought it up. Harp brings out that kind of feminine, if you like, character of the piano. Often the piano is introduced by solo harp, so the pianist has to match that timbre, and Jean-Yves does that masterfully. Particularly, the high point for me is the second movement at the end that the piano plays with one hand, accompanied by the harp.
And, of course, the sonority and the dynamics of the two instruments, similar, but you really need a very fine touch to accompany a harp on a piano.
Well, we have two fantastic musicians, one from the orchestra and the other one, Jean-Yves. And I feel that with the chamber character, this one as a duo, brings or highlighting elements in the orchestra that is much cherished by the musicians, and that is highlighting solo passages. So here I think this is a chance for the harp and the solo piano to have, to me, it's kind of a spiritual relationship because, you know, the entire orchestra and entire hall is listening to them. And
an intimate conversation.
It is intimate. To me, music is always a spiritual, meaning that in all cultures have traditions and have, they speak to the higher authority, higher forces through music. And in all levels, music is very personal way of communicating with our inner self and also with our with others as well.
Often when a musician has a piece created specifically for them, they will spend time in the room with the composer and say, oh, it's wonderful, because, you know, normally I can't talk to Beethoven. But in this instance, I can talk to the composer. Conversely, is that something you're happy about? Because some composers would say everything you need to know is on the page.
I believe there is a dialogue, and the history of that dialogue goes back to 18th century, 19th century, when the separation of composer and performer was evident, particularly in 19th century. Obviously, Jean-Yves knows the instrument better than me, and I listen to him. It's a give and take. That's a relationship that is healthy and constructive. Luckily, he didn't ask me to change much. Although I'm not a pianist, but he's happy with what I wrote. And the credit goes to him because he could really play anything in the world. You know, it's just an incredible technical facility as well as musicianship that he could make any passage work and make it convincingly. As a result, it was a really happy collaboration. I must say, I listened to him a number of times before the composition, so I had a pretty good sense of his personality on the piano, and I tried to incorporate that personality and fuse it into the concerto.
Sort of like channeling his voice as you were writing that, but were there any surprises when you heard him then play the piece? Did he... I don't know. It always sounds better than it looks on the page, but were there particular interpretations that he gave to things that surprised you?
I knew he would do a masterful performance, but he even did better than my extreme expectation. And that's a really a sign of great artist, that he could look at the black and white notes and try to get to the heart of the musical character. And he did that, and he owns the piece. The way he plays it is like it comes from him. For that, I'm very grateful to him.
And you say you got to the heart of the piece, but a lot of the time, as going back to the start of our conversation, Western musicians, they understand what the notes say, but they may not understand the heart of the music. Do you think he got to the Persian elements of the concerto?
You know, I must tell you a story that after the first time I saw him, after learning the piece, he was humming the tune of the third movement all the time, and I felt that he was dancing to it. So he got it right.
Behzad Ranjbaran, the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Robert Spano, performs his piano concerto with soloist Jean-Yves Thibaudet at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8 and tomorrow afternoon at 2. The program also includes two works by Sibelius, the Suite No. 1 from The Tempest and his Symphony No. 5.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Rumors of the retirement of Anonymous Four, the hugely popular a cappella vocal group, have been greatly exaggerated, but for a reason. The group planned what they called a hiatus, only to discover that the quirky postscript to the group's popular discography of medieval music was their biggest hit ever, a collection of folk songs titled American Angels. But even though they've cut their schedule from 75 to 25 concerts a year, the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society presents this female vocal quartet every Christmas. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stern spent an afternoon with two of the group's members this week in their Manhattan home base, got the story on their aborted retirement, and what it is that their imitators can't seem to imitate.
Anonymous Four often seems more like a quartet of priestesses than a group of musicians. The repertoire is liturgical music from the end of the first millennium to 1400, sung with voices that cast spells not just in concert, but over your car radio while you're in some thoroughly modern traffic jam. In person, there's nothing disillusioning about them. Maybe you just don't expect them to be so, well, feet on the ground in sensible shoes.
We're people with lives, and life happens to each of us in a different way, just the way it does for everybody else. People also tend to think that we're taller than we are. But I think it's the energy of the music itself, or something.
Marcia Gorensky admits that the individual members of the group do have their quirks.
Well, I'm a chocoholic. Is that bad? Well, a couple of us like a nice glass of wine after a concert. We don't do it during a concert, and we know people who do at intermission, but we don't do that.
I'll bet Gorensky and the others are vegetarian. Only sometimes, she says.
The food thing is unbelievable. It ranges back and forth with the same people sometimes between I will not eat my animal's friends to the Atkins diet and then off in some other direction.
The Philadelphia Chamber Music Society is presenting the group for the 10th time on Friday and, as always, just before the holidays. After all, five of the group's 19 albums have had a Christmas theme, including the latest disc, The Cherry Tree. Yet there's a year-round quality to the music making. The title cut of The Cherry Tree would sit easily at some homespun American folk festival. Therein lies the story of Anonymous Four's retirement that didn't happen. Fault was Gorensky's.
What happened was we decided we really did want to go from full-time to part-time, but in the meantime, we were going to take a hiatus. And that meant that we ran around all over the country, all over the world, doing lots and lots of performances before we were going to take this hiatus of unknown length.
While at the University of Pennsylvania, Gorensky studied folk culture and folk music, and she wasn't the only group member to hear a similarity between medieval European music and what Americans call folk music, even if the exposure, in Hellenauer's case, was pretty limited.
I never was involved in folk music in any way, shape, or form, except I really loved Simon and Garfunkel. What happened was I was listening to the radio, and they were doing a little show on American traditional and art music. And all I could hear was the harmonies of medieval music. And I knew about this music. It was not like I didn't know it existed. I liked it fine, but for some reason, this presentation just really put the emphasis on those kind of spare harmonies. But I heard medieval music in my ear.
The record label Harmonia Mundi was tentatively supportive of this new direction, but the resulting album, titled American Angels, was more popular than anything they'd done before. And for a group with this much crossover appeal, that's saying a lot. Important common denominator between this and the group's usual medieval repertoire is that the music functions to support the words. That's central to the Anonymous Four aesthetic.
We really think of music as heightened speech.
Sometimes I have to rewrite the words because they're anti-Semitic. There are cases in a few of our concerts where we either had to leave something out, it's a beautiful piece of music, but oh my goodness, and this really says something we don't want to say. And also statements about women, you know, the abuse of women. And so it's not all loveliness.
But much of it is. And the most tangible aspect of the music that has come down through the centuries is the rudimentary notation that was only meant to jog the memories of people who knew it already. Musically, you're lucky if a single melodic line survives. But that can count for a lot, says Garansky.
The simplicity is really not the whole picture. The whole picture is the depth and the power of the music. And a lot of people may know that a lot of the music that we sing is sacred because that's the music that got written down. And we can feel the power of the faith that went into the creation of those bits of music. It's in the actual music, and we can actually bring that to life. It may not sound the way that person heard it back in 1300, but the power of it will come out.
Interestingly, they're as shy about talking about their specific spiritual bent as they are about stating their ages. They also swear there's no feminist undercurrent to what they do. Though this may sound contradictory, Anonymous 4 doesn't muddy its waters with politics or religion. But Hellenauer says it's about a belief in belief.
The need to have faith in something beyond yourself, that's the universal concept, and that's what you find in works of art that are impelled by faith. The need to believe and the need to reach out beyond yourself, and that's what art does. And it's tied to words in our case.
Even the famous Anonymous 4 vocal blend arises naturally not out of vocal compatibility, according to Hellenauer, but intellectual compatibility.
The vocal blend has nothing to do with trying to make our voices sound alike. It has to do with the interpretation of the line that we're singing. So if we all agree on where the high points of the line are, where the text goes, you know, both the rhetoric and the weight of the syllables that we're singing and the musical shapes, the gestures that go with them, then we're going to sound blended.
It has to do with agreeing and coming to what we call a unity of intent about how a word, a phrase, a section, a piece goes. And it also has to do with deciding what the vowels sound like.
In a way, Anonymous 4 is best defined by what it isn't. Were they carrying a banner for medieval women composers, they would be typecast. If they had a religious agenda, their music might become evangelical. The more one listens to Anonymous 4, the more their hallmark seems to be their ability to give a vocal platform for the music at hand and then stay out of its way. That's mostly noticeable when you hear their imitators. The superb Trio Medieval from Norway has a vocal blend that's more like three voices coming together in one big super voice. One of the newest trios on the scene, the Berlin-based Trifonia, is gussied up with instruments and sings with a much more personal vocal interpretation. It's all very engaging, but seems to inhabit a rather limited universe next to the open-ended interpretive neutrality of Anonymous 4. In the symphonic world, interpretive neutrality can seem noncommittal. But while driving up to New York to meet Anonymous 4, I put on their CD and, despite the holiday chaos, everything around me seemed strangely manageable. And that reaction is nothing compared to the kind of stories that the group constantly hears about its recordings being played in pediatric wards and hospices to welcome souls on the way into the world and to soothe those on the way out. The group members are moved when they hear of such things, but they say they can't think about them for too long. They just concentrate on singing.
Choir's David Patrick Stearns. The Anonymous Four perform at the Holy Trinity Church in Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia on Friday and at the Leffler Chapel and Performance Center in Elizabethtown on Saturday. Over the past three decades, Bill Cunliffe has played with some of the greats, including Buddy Rich, Frank Sinatra, Ray Brown, and James Moody. As a composer, his works have been performed by the Cincinnati Pops and the Illinois Philharmonic, among others. Now resident in California, Cunliffe taught at Temple University's Boyer School of Music during the early 2000s. He returned earlier this year to work with the Temple University Symphony Orchestra on his fourth stream, La Banda, a piece commissioned for the ensemble and the highly acclaimed trumpeter Terrell Stafford, Temple's Director of Jazz Studies. It was announced earlier this week that Cunliffe's fourth stream, La Banda, had been nominated for a 2010 Grammy Award for Best Instrumental Composition. When I spoke with the composer, I first asked him about the title of the piece.
Gunther Schuller and John Lewis coined a term, third stream, in the 50s, which was a cross between classical music and jazz. And the piece is actually built on the bass line of a very famous John Lewis piece called Django. I call this fourth stream because I think that Latin and world music and percussion is the fourth stream. So you kind of add that to it. And then La Banda is because the end of the piece, it's kind of a, not exactly a fight between orchestra and band, but a duel between orchestra and band. And the band wins in the end, but the orchestra joins in and just kind of integrates itself with the band.
It's interesting that you mention all those different influences, because when you were growing up, there was music in the house, but it was principally classical music. Your mother was a pianist.
That's right.
And you've also had all these huge Latin influences. You spent time in Brazil and things like that.
That's right.
Do all of these influences live with you every time you sit down to compose?
I think subconsciously they do. I think with a piece like this, what was really fun for me, it was a chance to fuse kind of the three main things that I love, which is Latin music, jazz, and classical music. It was an ability to kind of synthesize all of them and put them into one thing. It really, this piece really is the expression of what I love and enjoy as a performer and as a composer.
I read somewhere that you're more drawn to harmony than melody, but you're a bit of a dab hand at the melody as well.
Well, that's interesting that you read that. I think, you know, I'm English and Scottish and there's some Irish in there. So I've always been really attracted to the English melodists, Holst, Vaughan Williams, Delius, etc. So I think melody comes to me first. I think I'm more of a melodist than a harmonist, because I think that I know when I was in music school, I had melodic things that I wanted to do, but then when I found more things out about harmony, I was able to kind of integrate those in. And I would also say that the reason I playing piano and clarinet, and the reason I pick piano is that you can play more than one note at a time.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I am a harmony guy after all.
When you're given a commission, where does it start? Have you got a piece of melody in your head, or do you have a sort of an intellectual outline?
Well, I had the idea to do this piece many years ago, because I always thought that I love the piece Django, and I love the idea of a jazz composer playing a classical sounding piece. Django starts out sounding like classical, but then it goes into jazz. So I thought this is the perfect way to kind of integrate the two and then overlay the Latin element on top of that. And Terrell is the perfect guy for that. A, very fine classical trumpet player. B, a world-class jazz player, that goes without saying. And thirdly, he understands Latin music really, really well. He's got a real intuition for it.
Are there certain technical, musical things that you need to be aware of the abilities of the players before you sit down to write it?
I think that Ellington was the prime example of you have a band and then you write for who's in the band. And I think that all composers to a certain level do that. Brahms enlisted Joseph Joachim to help him with the violin concerto. I think the player is intimately involved in the piece, and I think that to a degree, if the player is involved in the composition in terms of some sort of basic technical musical schema, I think the better the piece will be.
Before you made the decision to become a professional musician, I think you were majoring in psychology, am I correct?
That's right.
And then you decided to become a professional musician.
Yeah.
Do you think that you would be making that decision if you were now one of your students? Because it's not getting any easier.
No. I think I would make the same decision. But I would say right now, it's a little tougher for these kids than it was for me, for a couple of reasons. Being the golden age of the music that we love is from the 1940s to the 60s, because the jazz in terms of swing music had essentially in the 1940s 80% of the popular music sold.
It was
America.
The popular music of the day, yeah.
Exactly. And that residual effect allowed bebop to flourish, because the best of the most successful Miles Davis, John Coltrane music, Stan Getz. That music was close enough to the popular music of the day that it was accepted readily by the people. By the time we got into the late 60s, no longer the case. Jazz had to change, and Miles Davis, through Bitches Brew, gave jazz kind of a new leg to stand on. Right now, the popular music of our day and jazz, the intersection is a little tougher to find, number one. Number two, the whole idea of getting people to pay for content is in tatters. And that combined with a rather substantial economic downturn. So we've got three things going on right now that make it tougher for young people. I feel sorry for them. But I think that all economic times get better. People do adjust. The musical training that kids are getting is very, very good, at least at the upper echelon. I mean, Temple is just a wonderful school, and the level of the students now is even higher than when I was here.
Finally, if there is a Bud Powell or a John Coltrane or a Bill Conliffe enrolled in Temple's music school today, will that person become all they could be? Where is he going to be in 10 years?
He'll do just fine. He'll probably be a little more multimedia and bifurcated and diverse. He'll be playing, he'll be promoting his own concerts, he'll be composing, he'll probably be teaching a little bit, he'll probably be writing film scores, he'll be accompanying singers. He'll do okay. Music isn't going to go away.
Excerpt from Bill Conliffe's fourth string, La Banda, for orchestra, jazz combo, and solo trumpet. Temple University Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Luis Biava, with Terrell Stafford on trumpet. That piece has been nominated for the 2010 Grammy for Best Instrumental Composition. The 53rd Annual Grammy Awards Ceremony will take place in Los Angeles in February. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milanoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.